Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, spirits on earth and others channeling in from unknown elsewheres. We're privileged to have you sitting around the electronic campfire with us for the inaugural podcast of Evolver and Reality Sandwich. Coming in from every corner of this heavenly body, bouncing off of satellites, running through billions of miles of tubes and plugging directly into the new terra firma of the cyber-wired landscape, the shared mind of humanity that is the post-internet apocalypse, you're tuned in to the very front of the evolutionary bullet train. Hold on, folks, and welcome to tomorrow. Expect us around the corner every month for unusual and highly necessary programming. On this month's edition, we're very pleased to be joined by Rupert Sheldrake, who's going to talk to us about his latest book, Setting Science Free. It's about time that that happened. We're also going to give you a little taste of the ayahuasca monologues we recorded earlier this year. And author Daniel Moeller will tell us about his latest book, Machine Elves 101, or Why Terence McKenna Matters. And if you're here, you know he certainly does. Music for this month's edition has been brought to us by East Forest. So please take a moment to make yourself feel at home and enjoy a few words and ideas from the threshold of rational apprehension. You're tuned in to the Evolver and Reality Sandwich podcast.
Next up, you may have seen him with the likes of Terence McKenna and Jiddu Krishnamurti. Vanguard evolutionary biologist Rupert Sheldrake talks to us about his new book, Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discovery.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Roberts for RealitySandwich.com. I have the one and only Dr. Rupert Sheldrake on the line. Dr. Sheldrake is known for his theory on morphic fields and morphic resonance. He's just released his latest book, Science Set Free, in which he addresses the ideas that have become dogmas in modern scientific thought, and exposes their faults and offers solutions for a way forward. Dr. Sheldrake, you discovered these morphic fields. What are they, and what's the evidence to support them?
Morphic fields are the fields that organize the shape or form of living organisms like plants and animals. They're like the kind of invisible plans that shape them. And the idea of morphogenetic fields or short form shaping fields has been quite well known in biology for a long time, over 90 years. That's not an original part of mine, it's a pretty mainstream idea. The key part of my theory is that there's a kind of memory in the fields, that each organism draws on a collective memory and in turn contributes to it. And the evidence for that is that there are mysterious memory effects that occur in living things. For example, if you train rats to learn a new trick in New York, then rats all around the world should learn the same trick quicker just because the rats have learned it in New York. And there's actual evidence from experiments at Harvard and in Australia and Scotland that effect really happens.
That's pretty wild. I've heard about that sort of thing. How does this work together with sort of the more recent discoveries in your book, Science Set Free? You talk a little bit about the Higgs boson and the significance that it may have. What's the correlation there?
Well, this doesn't have much to do with the Higgs boson, which is a theory in physics about how things get their mass. But what the Higgs boson does is really just remind us how little we understand about the fundamental nature of matter. After all, the Higgs boson is supposed to explain why anything has mass. We all take for granted that things that are, you know, weigh a pound, if you buy a pound of fruit, it weighs a pound. We take weight and mass completely for granted. And yet, it turns out it's completely unexplained in physics and depends on this boson that was detected elusively, just a few months ago. And even then, it leaves many questions unanswered. One of the points I make in Science Set Free is that we understand so much less than we usually assume we do. And in relation to genes and inheritance, for example, people thought that the Genome Project would explain the vast majority of heredity. It turns out it explains only about 5 to 10% in most cases. And there's now a crisis in the heart of biology called the missing heritability problem. It's not in the genes. I think that's because it's in morphic resonance, this collective memory I was just speaking about.
That's interesting because when I read that in the book, I kept getting this metaphor in my head, like they were looking for their keys in the wrong pair of pants or something. Where?
Yes.
Exactly.
I mean, the whole of biology has been based on this assumption that it's all molecular and genetic for decades now. And as I show in my book, Science Set Free, hundreds of billions of dollars have been invested on the assumption that this genetic view of inheritance is the whole truth, or almost the whole truth. And it turns out it's not. And there's been a vast waste of money, public and private money, on this project, which has been a disastrous failure, as the Harvard Business School showed in a recent report.
What's the general consensus or the reaction to some of the things that you're bringing up? In my estimation, when I read the book, it seemed pretty clear. You'd lay out what the problem was, how it had turned into a dogma, and then sort of brought forth some solutions. What are some of the biggest presumptions that have been made that have been turned into dogmas, and how do you address those?
Well, in my book, I deal with 10 different dogmas. One is that matter, the total amount of matter and energy, is always the same. Another is that nature is mechanical or machine-like. Another is that heredity is all carried in the genes. These are three of the 10 dogmas I address. I've said something just now about heredity and the genes, but take matter and energy, the total amount always being the same, except at the moment of the Big Bang when they all appeared from nowhere. That's the usual assumption. It turns out that physicists have invented or discovered that there's now huge amounts of so-called dark matter and dark energy. We don't have a clue what they are, but they now make up 96% of reality, and they've added them in the last 30 years. Now, if the total amount of matter and energy is always the same, is the total amount of dark matter and energy always the same? Well, no one has a clue. Actually, the total amount of dark energy seems to be increasing as the universe expands.
Right.
So, the whole thing's a shambles, really. And what we all learned at school and thought was a sort of fixed law turns out to be relating only to 4% of the matter and energy in the universe. And we don't know the relation of that 4% with the rest.
That's just craziness. I remember when I first learned about dark matter and dark energy, it was life-changing to me in many ways. At the time that I had done it, I was an evangelical Christian. I was like, well, see, that dark energy is God. But obviously that was kind of flipped around. But speaking on those terms, I found that in a lot of recent things being talked about with the Higgs, a lot of the scientists use the word magic to say, well, we put these things in here, and just like magic, it pops back out. And it reminded me of the quote that you did from Terence McKenna, where he says, science just asks for one small miracle, and then they'll be sure to take care of the rest. I found that quite amusing.
Yes, that's a great quote of Terence's. Yes, I mean, it's that's it. You know, science just says, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nothing in a single instant.
That's just a small miracle.
Yes.
So you've also dealt a lot with experimenting with being stared at. It was fun. I watched some YouTube videos on it and have read some of your other work on it. And it's very interesting because that's the sort of thing that seems so simple to the average person, and yet the a scientific materialist might say, well, that's just nonsense. How it blows my mind sometimes when something as simple as that would be denied. And is that one of the ways in which sort of this dogma has become blinding?
Well, I think so. You see, one of the 10 dogmas I discuss in Science Set Free is that the mind is inside the head. The assumption of materialism is that the mind's nothing but the activity of the brain, therefore it's all inside the head. And that means that when you look at somebody, your image of that person's inside your head. It's not out there in any way, and looking at somebody shouldn't be able to affect them. Yet, almost everybody's had the experience that you can tell when you're being looked at from behind. You turn around, someone's looking at you, or you look at somebody and they turn around. So that suggests the sense of being stared at is real, and it's found all over the world. I've interviewed surveillance officers, private detectives, and so forth. They all take it completely for granted. It's trained in the martial arts. You can train this ability and get better at it. And I've done lots of experiments, and so have many other people now, showing that this is indeed a real phenomenon. Now, that's no surprise to most people because they've experienced it, and so have most of their friends and family. So the phenomenon's well known, and yet there'd been an almost complete systematic denial of its existence in science for 100 years, because it ought not to happen, because if the mind's inside the head, it's impossible. Therefore, the evidence was dismissed as illusory. And there are still organized groups of skeptics who take that line and try and just explain it all away as just coincidence. Yet, the scientific evidence shows it's real, and if it's real, it shows that something about our mind reaches out to touch what we're looking at. And I think, in fact, our minds are extended far beyond our brains. They're a bit like cell phones in that sense, that the cell phone has a field, an electromagnetic field, which is inside the cell phone, but its field invisibly extends far beyond the cell phone. That's why cell phones work. Because of this influence that stretches out beyond them. And so what I'm suggesting is our minds are a bit like that. Of course, they're in the brain, but they stretch out far beyond the brain, far beyond our bodies, in every act of perception, every time we look at something, and through our intentions. When we have an intention to do something, that intention reaches out. For example, if I have an intention to make a phone call to somebody, my intention precedes making the call. And what happens very often is extremely common, is that people start thinking about someone for no apparent reason. Right. Then that person calls and they say, that's funny, I was just thinking about you. I think that's because they pick up the intention before the call's actually made. And it's in fact a kind of telepathy. That's another of the dogmas I talk about in Science Set Free, the dogma that psychic phenomena are illusory. They're impossible because the mind's in the brain, therefore they can't happen.
Right.
In fact, they do happen. And telephone telepathy, which, again, for 100 years, was denied by so-called skeptics as just coincidence, turns out to be a real phenomenon. And again, about 80% of the population have experienced it, so it's no surprise to most people. And I now have an automated telephone telepathy test running in the U.S. So, in fact, let me invite any listeners to do it themselves. This is something you can actually try yourself. You go to my website, sheldrake.org, sheldrake.org, and there's the online experiments portal. So it's a fun, easy-to-do test that's now running automatically all over the United States. So, and these tests are showing above-chance results.
You've spoken about shamanism as well, and how these people are going into whole other realms and are sort of bridging a gap between them. That's a really exciting thing to hear about, especially coming from a scientist. How do you, as you know yourself, how do you bridge the gap between when we talk about things like telepathy and the phenomenon of shamanic experience?
Well, I think that the mind is extended far beyond the brain. I think that our every perception, it stretches out, as I was just saying. And I think we also have access to collective memories. And I think that mystical experiences of various kinds, shamanic and otherwise, involve our mind contacting other mental realms or mental realities, which are not inside other people's brains or even inside animal brains, too. Well, they are inside them, but they stretch out beyond them. So I think that these psychic abilities, like telepathy and mystical experiences, are all to do with extensions of the mind and the contacting of other minds. Mystical experiences are to do, I think, with contacting higher forms of consciousness in the world. I think that the Earth itself has a mind, that the Sun has a mind, the whole solar system, the whole galaxy. I think we live in a living world, and there's many levels of consciousness. The materialist worldview, the one I'm criticizing in Science Set Free, says that we live in an unconscious universe. Matter's unconscious, and for some unknown reason it becomes conscious in human brains. But otherwise, the rest of the universe is just unconscious. We're the only conscious beings within it, except perhaps for a few other animals and other species of animals and maybe little green men on other planets. But we live in an unconscious universe. That, I think, is profoundly wrong. I think we live in a universe that's alive and full of minds and consciousness, and that's what people have thought traditionally all over the world. It's what Christians thought in the Middle Ages. It's what shamans think. It's what Buddhists think, what Hindus think. It's what virtually all people think all over the world, except people who've had a materialist education.
Well, it's the way you phrased that was so eloquent. There was a time in my life where your work actually directly affected my view, because I had walked away from evangelical Christianity and sort of went into this, I kind of went the Ricky Gervais way for a little while, where I just said, well, science is the only thing that I can rely upon. But then I felt this very deep sense of yearning, this sense of loss at something that I had in some way that was special. And your work, especially talking about how don't live in a cold universe, that there is something going on beyond our realms of perception. Just that little seed was one of the great encouragements of my adult life, and I appreciate that. One of the things that came up was in reading the book, you talk about Francis Crick and the discovery of DNA and things like that. And of course, there have been stories that go on about his use of lysergic acid. And one thing that I wondered about, especially with my own psychedelic experiences, is I wondered, and it's kind of, I suppose, a personal question for each of us as individuals, I wonder how he could have gone through the use of something like LSD and still maintain sort of the materialist view that he held to ongoing. I don't know if there's really an answer for that, but it seemed almost impossible to me, because you blast beyond your perception. Is there a way to just justify it from a mechanistic sort of view?
Well, I think. Well, obviously, some people do. Crick's one of them. I mean, LSD for many people is a really mind-opening experience that shows there's some other dimension to consciousness. But if you're a materialist and a committed one, as Crick was, he was deeply committed. He was a militant atheist and an evangelical materialist. All his life, or at least all his adult life. It was a huge part of his motivation to try and remove any mystery from life or the universe, to show it's all just science. I suppose that for materialists, if they take LSD and it works, then they can be amazed by the experience, of course, but then when they come round from it and are trying to think about it, they'll say, well, there, that just proves materialism because it's a chemical molecule, and a chemical molecule can have this huge effect on consciousness, therefore consciousness is just chemical.
Right.
And so you can see how basically an experience induced by LSD or any other psychedelic, or indeed by any method that induces mystical changes, experience, breathing, exercises, fasting, or whatever. One could say, well, here are these chemical influences on the brain that cause changes in consciousness. Now, some materialists would take that as proof of materialism. What we have to do, I think, is see that our consciousness depends on a kind of interaction between the mental dimension and the brain. Obviously, the brain's got something to do with it. Brain damage can lead to loss of memory, and it can lead to unconsciousness and so forth. So clearly, it involves the brain, but that doesn't prove it's nothing but the brain. And if I came and tinker with your TV set, I could alter its tuning so that it wouldn't get some channels and would always be stuck on other ones, but that wouldn't prove that all the programs you're seeing on TV arise inside the TV set and are generated by it. And I think that the effects of LSD and other psychoactive drugs on the brain in a way changes the tuning system of the brain so that different kinds of consciousness are accessed. It doesn't prove it's all generated inside the brain.
That's amazing. Well, I know that you have a limited amount of time, but I did want to let people know that your book, Science Set Free, is available now. I just really wanted to thank you for your time, Dr. Sheldrake. It's a pleasure and an honor to have spoken with you, and we're going to let people know and get the word out. This is an amazing book, and I highly recommend it for anybody who's interested in continuing their quest for truth and better understanding of the universe.
Good. It's very good to talk to you, Gabriel.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sheldrake. We'll be in touch later. Thank you so much, sir.
Right. Bye. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Sheldrake. Thank you very much for listening, and please go pick up a copy of Science Set Free. I guarantee you're going to love it.
Everybody, welcome to Reality Sandwich Podcast. I'm Odd, and I'm joined by Sister H. Hey there, Sister H. How's it going?
Hey there, Odd. And right now, we have a roundup of news stories from Reality Sandwich.
We do. They've been floated our way, and it looks like some of them are pretty interesting. I got one here that says, extrasensory perception, once science fiction, now science fact.
Recently, researchers at Northwestern University announced new findings that support the existence of something called presentiment. Presentiment is when someone is actively aware of an event before it takes place. And this is the interesting part right here, is that they examined 26 studies taken from 1978 to 2010, so for a long time right there, a nice big chunk of data. And the analysis suggests that if you can tune into your body, your bodily sort of awareness, then you can sense what's coming around the corners. You know, they've done the same thing with, like, the skin tests, where they test your skin electricity or something like that, and you can feel if you're about to be shown a grotesque image. They do, like, a random image thing.
Yeah, before it happens.
Right, and I think that's presentiment right there.
Right.
You feel it coming. Interesting.
In the mind.
Yeah, really, like, you somehow know it's coming. Fascinating. What else we got going on here?
Okay, let's see, what's next? Well, we've all been talking about the Mayans for the past year, and then some.
Vogue.
Mm-hmm. But what actually caused the downfall of the Mayan civilization?
Yeah, it's a
mystery. That's the question.
Right? Yeah.
Well, a paper published this month in the journal Science makes the case that the culprit was actually climate change.
Shocker.
A team led by environmental anthropologist Douglas Kennett studied rainfall records and found that the Maya society was healthy during periods of rain, while drier periods led to unrest. I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I guess it doesn't have to do with their offshore drilling operations, though.
Maybe food supply.
Ah.
And they identified a period of extended drought at the same time that the Maya civilization collapsed.
Ah.
Oh, perhaps they all died.
Well, or I guess they died or disappeared or walked away. They got tired of the shapes, looking at the same shapes every day.
Yeah. No water, no civilization.
Interesting.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Well, Kennett says the Maya provide a cautionary tale for us today.
Yeah, don't they? Don't they? Well, I guess civilization is always a cautionary tale for the next civilization, isn't it?
That's right, Odd. But let's move on to...
The planet with four suns. A planet with four suns. A planet with four suns has recently been discovered by two, I love this, citizen astronomers. So guys on the street who are part of Planet Hunters, a collective of non-professional astronomers that work in collaboration with NASA and Yale. Cool, cool. The planet dubbed PH1, after the Planet Hunters, is a gas giant located in the Cygnus constellation, 5,000 light years away. Never been there.
Yeah, Cygnus. Sounds ominous.
But PH1, PH2. I hope we see PH3, 4, 5, 6 soon, guys.
Let's do PH1.
Yeah. Well, PH1 is the first planet discovered by the Planet Hunters and has been likened to Tatooine. Now, if you're a Star Wars enthusiast, you realize that is a false likenedhood. Star Wars, Tatooine has two stars. It doesn't have four. There's no four-star planet in the Star Wars lexicon. It doesn't exist. It's been likened to Tatooine inappropriately.
Maybe they needed to liken it to something.
Yeah, something. Yeah, you're right.
In the cultural pantheon of references.
No, Star Wars is the place to go. Taoism.
It's kind of irrelevant.
Well, here's something.
And something even more irrelevant. And closer to home.
Yeah.
Only a little bit, though. Peruvian shamans have predicted Obama's presidential victory using... This is ridiculous. We can't even report on this. Sorry.
Pre-Columbian ceremonies. Fascinating.
Perhaps, yeah.
Well, what I like about it is you have to come up with the vision of it. So, I mean, it's a piece of news that is relevant in a way because it's how one culture is drastically different from another one. See, we do statistical analysis, we do probability, we do polling and all that kind of stuff. But in Peru, they don't. In Peru, they put flower petals on the photos of the candidates, they chew coca leaves, and then they drink ayahuasca.
Yeah, and that sounds a lot more fun to me.
And Juan Osco, the shaman of the Andes, said that the Apus, I guess, gods of the hills in the indigenous mythology, told them of Obama's coming re-election. I kind of wish they would have asked for any other insight regarding any other thing. Any other place in the world than that. If you have access to that kind of information.
Yeah, it would have been good to get them kind of on the money about something like really obscure.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really unpredictable.
Because I could probably tell you that without ayahuasca, coca leaves, or flower petals.
Yeah, we could have sat right here in my bed and just kind of
figured it out.
Yeah.
You can't really win.
A fairly good guess. Well, the next piece of news about something that'll tickle you pink.
There you go. The happiest man in the world, on the planet, has been found. I love the way you say it. How do you say his name?
Mathieu Ricard,
a 66-year-old Tibetan monk and geneticist. Now, researchers found that Ricard's brain produces a level of gamma waves that are off the chart. And gamma waves, are linked to consciousness, attention, learning, and memory. But apparently, I guess they also have something to do with happiness. He's just blasting happy waves. And he says the secret to his blissful success is meditation, you know. And I don't know. Sister H, have you ever tried meditation?
I have. Have you, Odd?
Oh, yeah, constantly.
Makes you happier?
Definitely makes me happier.
Me too.
Definitely makes me much happier.
No doubt about it. It's kind of a no-brainer, as they say around here. Appropriately. It's kind of getting rid of your brain and connecting to a larger brain, if you will.
Yeah, a smarter brain.
A smarter brain that has no brain waves.
We're all looking for a brainwaveless death state. Mm-hmm. Anyone can be happy, according to Ricard, by simply training their brain for happiness.
I think that's the message for the day. Well, no, that's a bad way of saying it, but training one's brain.
Training one's brain. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, because civilization, that's going to train your brain for one thing, and it might not make you happy. Mm-hmm. It's what it's going to train you for. So.
Yeah, what are we training our brain for?
Buying things. Yeah. Finding things to buy, I would say. That's the agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much it. Yeah. Finding things to buy and then
finding people to listen to. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me, it's a pretty narrow walk down the street, you know?
Yeah. Well. Buying things, discarding them, and buying new things.
Of course. And of Oh, gosh.
Finding new people to listen to, tiring of them, and then finding other people to listen to.
Mm. Well, I will probably listen to Ricard right here. Briefly.
Oh, I'll definitely take a leaf out of his book and
I want to see what powerful gamma waves feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Well, this is a nice rambling bite, and that's the latest news from Reality Sandwich. Thanks for joining us. I'm Odd.
And I'm Sister H, and we look forward.
We do look forward. We look forward, we look backward, we look side to side. We've got more coming for you, coming up next. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Up next is our interview with Daniel Moeller, author of Machine Elves 101, or Why Terence McKenna Matters.
He's a legend in the underground, a password in the counterculture, and I don't think I'd be met with much resistance if I called him one of the spiritual godfathers of Evolver, Reality Sandwich, and the psychedelic renaissance that we are enjoying today, in the same way that Charles Fort is no doubt a spiritual godfather of Coast to Coast AM. He was the author of Invisible Landscape, True Hallucinations, The Archaic Revival, and The Tree of Life, The Tree of Knowledge, among others. He now exists in the media record as a cyberdelic philosopher within the depths of the internet. I'm speaking, of course, of the great Terence McKenna. And joining me now is Daniel Moeller, the author of Cactus Mystery, Red Mass, the Simon Myth Chronicles, and most recently the Reality Sandwich e-book single Machine Elves 101, or Why Terence McKenna Matters. He writes on postmodernism, consciousness, and shamanism, and runs the Daedalus thread at DanielMoeller.com. And beaming in from Kansas is Daniel Moeller. Good to finally be with you.
Hey, how are you?
No, I'm not bad at all. Did I miss anything in there?
No, it sounds like you got everything, so thank you very much.
Now, you've done something that probably everyone who's ever bumped into McKenna and hasn't stuck to him has wanted to do at one point or another, which is to, you know, write a book about the guy. So when did you bump into Terence McKenna?
Well, I was actually writing my master's thesis on James Joyce's Ulysses, and so I was very interested in this concept of time. If you know, Ulysses takes place in the course of one day, and it's a massive book, so there's a lot going on in there in one day, and so I was writing about the fluctuation and deconstruction of time, you know, from a liberal arts perspective. And in my research, I literally just stumbled across a Terence McKenna book, actually Archaic Revival. And the subtitle of it was so interesting: Speculations on Psychedelic Mushrooms, the Amazon, Virtual Reality, UFOs, Evolution, Shamanism, the Rebirth of the Goddess, and the End of History, that I thought, well, I got to pick that up.
as anyone would, but
and so that's basically it. That's basically how I stumbled into Terence, and I couldn't put the book down. I read it within a day and was just fascinated by his ideas and the delivery, and I never went back.
Now, I'm so glad you brought that up, because probably one of the most interesting things about McKenna that not everyone knows is he had this really brilliant mind when it came to people like Joyce and especially McLuhan. Have you had a chance to listen to him rap about either of those guys?
Joyce especially, yeah. And Finnegan's Wake was particularly a favorite of his. In fact, I think Finnegan's Wake was the book that he took with him to the Amazon when he and Terence did their little experiment with the I Ching.
Oh, I didn't know he brought that book down there. That really is probably one of my favorite interviews, is him just talking about Joyce and saying that it prepped him for the psychedelic experience or some such thing like that.
Absolutely, because James Joyce really was about using language as a way to deconstructing our value system as the way we use language, and opening up new doors and pathways. And which is probably the reason why a lot of people can't really stand to get into Joyce, because it's heavy. It's not a light read, and it's not for enjoyment. It's it's meant to be an experiment to see what we can do with language and how we can change the way we use our thoughts. And that's what McKenna was all about. So
that's fascinating. Have you done any experiments like that in your own work?
I try a little bit. Red Mass, my novel Red Mass especially, there are many chapters in there where I take the Joycean method of completely deconstructing language, along with other influences like the Beat Poets, William S. Burroughs, and just tried to cut everything up as far as my delivery and from what I know, those are usually the chapters where I was starting to lose the audience a little bit. But that's okay. It's fun, you know.
Was that the attraction to McKenna, the deconstruction of language and perception and time and so on?
Yeah, a little bit. But what really got me was just the ease with which he talked about the psychedelic experience. Mm. You know, I've always been interested in psychedelics and have experimented with them in the past. I've been into Aldous Huxley, of course, and Timothy Leary, but there was something about the clarity in which Terrence was able to talk about it, and in such a way that just made it so much more fun and interesting. The way he integrates these concepts of the UFO and other entities and aliens, and like I've referred to Terrence often as a gypsy, and that's very much what it's like, you know, reading one of his books or listening to one of his raps. That's the way he is, and which just, it engages the audience a lot more than trying to make a science out of it, which is what I know Leary and Huxley were trying to do. So.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that. He really is kind of the ultimate sort of late 20th century rambler, in a way, just kind of rolling from one thing to another and just picking up whatever sort of fits with whatever kind of dynamic he's playing with at the time.
Absolutely. And, you know, and how fitting that he ended up doing raves later in his career, which totally just fit his modus operandi, definitely. I've enjoyed that. I don't know if you've listened to his particular rave was Space-Time Continuum. That's actually one of the few CDs you can actually get out there on Amazon. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, is that the Alien Dreamtime one?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot of fun. That's a lot. That used to be on my iPod when I was going through New York.
There you go.
Talk about deconstructing a scene.
Absolutely.
So I guess he ended up sort of informing your postmodernist studies then?
He did, in a way. Basically, just in regards to, you know, the flavor that he had it. I wasn't really able to use much of his work in my master's thesis, but he definitely influenced me as far as, you know, again, how he separated from Leary and Huxley is the shamanic outlook that Terrence talked about quite a bit. And I've always been interested in that sort of thing and the indigenous shamanic perspective of healing and of consciousness. Mm. And I really like the way that he was bringing those concepts into the 20th century in a way that people could understand and relate to. So he really pushed me in the direction of actually seeking out more information on shamanic modalities and using plant medicines as a way of shamanic healing and expanding, you know, one's consciousness in that way.
You know, what do you think about his popularity? I mean, I'm only 25, and I bumped into him right after high school, which was around 2005 was when I graduated. And there was just this library of stuff on the internet. I mean, you just kind of started, and it just doesn't stop. You know, you keep on finding things that emerge just from the leftovers of it. So, and again, all kinds of people, from like academics and extremely literate people to, you know, more or less just regular guys who were just lucky enough to bump into him. And, you know, I think we opened up calling him a password into the counterculture. I mean, what do you think about his popularity? How do you think this came about?
Well, I think it was really more than anything grassroots, because I was very much into the drug culture and rave culture back in the 90s, and he was never on my radar. I never knew anything about him until just a few years ago, whenever I went to graduate school and stumbled across him. And as I've looked and seen how, you know, just it seems through word of mouth and really the internet, which I think that's the way Terrence would have wanted his popularity to grow. He was very much into the internet and into electronic culture as this egalitarian method of exchanging information, which to him was, you know, the way we were kind of getting in touch with that guy in what he called the guy in mind, or just the collective, you know, unconscious. So I think he would probably really would have preferred it that way, and just watched, and you can still see some of the, I think some of them are down now, but you can still see some of the older McKenna websites that are still up, and they're so clunky, and, you know, but just these archaic interfaces, but it's so fun to see how, you know, those have, you know, evolved over time, and, the library of information. And now, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, whenever I would YouTube a Terrence McKenna rap, and then now, I mean, just the amount of videos that have been uploaded, it's just exponential. It's crazy how popular he's getting. And again, it's not like nobody knows about him in the mainstream.
Right.
At all.
Yes.
And I find it so interesting. And in nowadays where, you know, we're starting to see modern psychology revisit psychedelics in a very tangible way, which is what he's always been calling for. So to see his kind of influence in the shadows, I guess, has been a lot of fun. It's got kind of like a trickster quality to it that I think is very Terrence. So I've been enjoying watching it grow.
I wonder if he anticipated it, that, you know, one day he wouldn't be with us or some such thing, and just made all this media like Brian Oblivion and Videodrome. So what do you think? Do you think you'd call him a philosopher? You said gypsy earlier.
Definitely. I think out of anything, I mean, I know a lot of that I've seen a lot of on forums and whatnot, people will sometimes refer to him as a scientist, and I think that he himself probably would have rejected that.
Oh, yes.
Definitely, I think philosophy was probably his primary love throughout his entire life. Specifically, metaphysical philosophy, alchemy was one of his great loves. You know, he rejected any kind of institution in regards to knowledge, anything that tried to lock down any kind of barriers in society in general, but just within our own minds. You know, he would reject those frameworks, and so his philosophy in particular was always about the deconstruction of that, to get back to, you know, the language of Joyce and the influence of James Joyce. I would definitely call him probably a philosopher more than anything else. I've been an entertainer, an entertaining philosopher.
Definitely. I was hoping that we would have more of those show up as he kind of caught on that philosophy would be. And, you know, one example of that might be like Slavoj Žižek, who's a sort of just almost a caricature in and of himself. So have you bumped into any machine elves yourself? I couldn't help myself. I had to ask.
I've definitely had my own experiences. I've only tried DMT once, and definitely it was one of those experiences that, you know, coming out of it, it took a while for me to kind of reintegrate back into into the real world. Interestingly enough, I never experienced the kind of very common template that McKenna found, and also Dr. Strassman's found in his work, in a DMT spirit molecule.
Sure.
And so that was much different. But I do a lot of work with this San Pedro cactus, I've experienced, you know, machine elf type entities with that. Yeah.
would you find them?
Talking about this sort of thing is really weird. Writing about it, it's one, but talking about it, it's like, man, how crazy does one sound?
I know what you mean. It's like when you write experiences down and someone comes across them later, it's like, oh, it's so fine, and like, okay, this is a private experience, very interesting. But yeah, indeed, once you begin a conversation about it, it's sort of like, oh yeah, sure, and the UFOs showed up, and you know, they showed me the heart of the galaxy and where I was born, and they were really friendly guys. You should meet them.
Right.
Let's see. Now, what do you think is his? I mean, despite the deconstructionism, especially now in a time where we're almost flooded with culture, that's, you know, I loved it. He said culture is an operating system that's not really working these days. So, despite his value as someone who advocates an experience that is outside of culture, what do you think is his most kind of valuable idea or contribution, if you had to pick one or two?
Well, I actually like the whole notion of the archaic revival. When he talked about, you know, how whenever a culture loses its bearing and starts basically going insane, it goes back to these, what he called anchoring models, which, you know, and that's what he calls the archaic revival. These models in Neo-Paleolithic times, you know, that he felt like that could be applied to today. And of course, that's the shamanic framework. And what makes his ideas and notions about this so interesting to me is that, you know, when anthropologists go to, you know, the Amazon or the outback or wherever it is they go to find their bushmen to study, they always do it, you know, from the outside of the culture. And so they always try to gain this objective experience of what's going on there. And what Terrence was all about was the experience of what he called the electric shaman. It was the person who would jump in to that culture and experience it and have a subjective experience. And that's what he encouraged everyone to do. He was very interested. In fact, he felt like the psychedelic experience was one of the most primal and vital elements of existence that we have. It was just as important as sex and death. And basically, if you don't have a psychedelic experience, it's like going through life never having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, that's, wow. I mean, that's a really bold statement. And so he was, you know, really interested in everybody taking part in this, and not just for the sake of just having a good party, although he totally wanted that, but to create a topography of the psychedelic landscape. There's this other world there that is unseen, and it's our job, it's our birthright to examine and explore, to be explorers of those other realms, to be psychonauts. And that's what we're here for. And we are now in the age of information. We have the capability of being able to do this and to do it ethically and to do it in such a way that we're not infringing on other people's rights. And now is the time. And that's what the archaic revival is all about. So I think that, I mean, that in and of itself is probably his most poignant idea. I think it intrigues me to no end.
Well, it seems like it's worked because a huge, I mean, they're calling it the psychedelic renaissance, has shown up, and I really don't think it would be here probably without him. I mean, such a voice for it, and it seems like it's expanding.
Oh, absolutely. I was, you know, whenever I interviewed his brother Dennis, if anything, you know, Dennis felt like, you know, Terrence never really contributed anything at all scientifically, but what he did do was definitely spark an interest in the psychedelic experience and really help cultivate a dialogue for people to have. The Palenque conferences, which have basically evolved to you know, many other things, and now we have MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. And so, again, yeah, now I literally can't go a week without, actually seeing on CNN or Yahoo News some study that's come out saying that, you know, MDMA or, you know, some other psychedelic substance, you know, is the possible cure for PTSD or depression. And, you know, this is awesome stuff. So I definitely think Terrence really helped cultivate the interest in that.
Yeah, it is quite an exciting time to have the internet around as this is happening.
Oh, absolutely, because now we can all take part in this. We can all take part in the dialogue, and we can all be a part of how this is going to form and where this is going to go, which... I mean, again, like I said earlier, that's why, I mean, Terrence was absolutely fascinated with the internet in his later years and thought that this was going to be our platform in order to create the counterculture to the dominating culture, is what he called the dominating culture at the time, which is all of our institutions, our governments, all of these, you know, frameworks that try to impede progress, whereas, you know, free exchange of information.
yeah, quite something.
Yeah.
So you kind of, I imagine, took this task upon yourself to write the intro. I mean, I'm so glad it has 101 in the title. I really am, because there's been so many times where I've said, you know, but you don't know Terrence McKenna, and then you're, as an enthusiast, you're kind of at a loss, because, well, do I give him this book, or do I give him the UFO lecture, the one on James Joyce? I mean, which is it gonna be? And so you've done Terrence McKenna 101.
Yeah, it was funny, because whenever I was just kind of getting started, really moving forward with my writing career a few years ago, a friend of mine from New York mentioned, you know, I've been trying to talk to my mom about Terrence McKenna, and I just can't, I don't know where to start. So do you think that you could write like a Terrence McKenna 101 thing? And I was like, well, fuck yeah, I will, absolutely. I don't know if we could. So, yeah, and so I wrote Machine Ales 101 as an article at first, so it was very succinct, and then Ken Jordan from Reality Sandwich was like, you know, we gotta build this up and make this a little bit more comprehensive and turn this into an ebook, so people just have the ultimate place to go. Anytime they need a good introduction to Terrence, they know all the best videos to go look at. Just like your ultimate, like, introductory resource to McKenna. Because, you know, I mean, his stuff is everywhere. I mean, there are bits and pieces all over the internet. And not everybody, I mean, who's going to sit down and read Invisible Landscape? That's it. And I did. And it was just like, God, it was a mind fuck. But it was fun. But, you know, it's only the really dedicated psychedelic geek is going to sit down and read through all his works. So I figured, yeah, I'm gonna take that challenge, and definitely. And it was fun. I mean, I there's definitely so much more that needs to be said, and there's so much more about his life that could be written about. And maybe we'll see that in we'll see that in Dennis's upcoming book. It should be coming out sometime this fall, hopefully.
Yes, that did look pretty exciting. That was probably one of the moments when I was reading your book where I kind of jumped up and down, especially at the title. What was it again?
Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss.
Yeah, I thought that was just... I don't know if you have a brother, but it's probably one of the most joyous things you can hear if you have a sibling.
Oh, yeah, that was great. And so I am definitely looking forward to getting a little bit more intimate into Terrence's life. Because, you know, I don't know if you've read True Hallucinations. He's got some biographical information in there, but... you can kind of tell. I mean, like I said, Terrence was a storyteller. So there's a lot, you can tell there's a lot of embellishment. There's a lot of, you know, okay, what was really going on there? And Dennis is great. I really loved talking with Dennis, and he's just such a practical person. And I know that he's just going to give, you know, the brass tacks of like what was really going on. And you know, he's basically, you know, when we talked about, you know, their experiments in the Amazon, I was really excited, and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to know all about the crazy magic that they did and all that stuff. And he was like, well, you know, I think maybe we might have just been, like, crazy, you know? He just, the way he came out of that, it was a fun conversation. But it was really nice to get that perspective. So I can't wait till it gets released.
You know, did your friend ever give a copy of your book to his mom?
She did. She the original article she did. And I mean, she just basically gave me a thumbs up and was like, yes, fine. You know, thank you so much. But I think the mother was just like kind of rolling the eyes and like, okay, so that's what my daughter is into.
You know, one of the things I really appreciated about Machine Elves was the library of video suggestions at the end of it. That was a really nice touch right there.
Yeah, that was a fun research project.
I bet.
To just sit around for, you know, weeks just, you know, watching every Terrence McKenna video on the net, but then having to parse down, you know, what to put in there, you know, was a little challenging because there are just so many fun ones. But it just came down to, you know, remember, this is an introductory. This is, you know, for someone stumbling upon Terrence for the first time, where are they going to get the most meat? So, yeah, definitely. Hopefully someone will take all those links and build one Terrence McKenna database on the internet. Maybe you're the man to do it.
there's a line waiting.
Yeah, I bet.
Do you have any more projects going on in this arena, whether psychedelic or McKenna-related?
Well, actually, one project I'm working on, and I've already talked with Ken at Evolver about it, is I'm working on a book on San Pedro. Mm-hmm. So that Cactus of Mystery book that you mentioned, I just have... that was written by Ross Heaven, who's written a book on San Pedro before, and I have bits of an article... in that book.
Oh, I see.
So I'm not an author of that book per se. But basically, you know, we wanted to write something that was a lot like Machine Elves, kind of just an introductory to San Pedro. And there's not a lot out there on San Pedro. Everything is about ayahuasca.
Right.
Now, which is awesome. But you know, we wanted to touch on something that not a whole lot of people know a lot about, and that I personally have a lot of experience with. So I'm in the process of working on that. I'm working on interviews right now with different curanderos from South America that have worked with the plant.
Oh, wonderful.
So yeah, I'm in research phase right now. So.
Okay. You know, I remembered what I wanted to ask you. Did you ever have a chance to listen to Terrence read Invisible Landscapes?
No, I have not.
All right, check YouTube, and Terrence goes through the whole story of him. I think it's Invisible Landscapes. Is that when they're in the Amazon?
True Hallucinations is like the account of them going to the Amazon, but Invisible Landscape is the experiment results.
Okay, no, this is them on their adventure right there.
Okay,
so I guess that's True Hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's Terrence reading it, and he does it in a radio play style with sound effects of the Amazon going on around him. I think you'd appreciate it. It's a really nice bedtime treat.
Oh, excellent. Something I can put my son to bed with. It's perfect for a 9-year-old.
Actually, it really is. It's actually awesome. A really nice little story. It's got almost a Lord of the Rings vibe to it or something.
Excellent.
So is there anything else you'd like to mention about your perspective on where we are right now regarding psychedelics, the internet, the media-drenched culture, and this postmodern situation that you have particular attention upon?
Not a whole lot, really. I think I've said my piece on that as far as what's important to me. Maybe a recap that, talked about this as what makes psychedelics significant is that they dissolve boundaries and they're ego suppressors, which is something that is in our media-drenched culture is very much needed right now. And why I think they're very important and they're drawing an entire group of not just young people, I mean, all, like we were saying earlier, all generations of people, jumping on this bandwagon because they're tired of the bullshit that, mainstream culture is, shoving down our throats. And we want to dissolve that and find something a little bit more authentic, something more, within ourselves that we can count on. I'd like to tap with that.
All right, that was Daniel Moeller. You can follow him at danielmoeller.com. Take a look at the Daedalus thread. It's a lot of fun up there, and find him on Facebook if you'd like. Daniel, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, thanks a lot. You take it easy.
You too. Enjoy yourself. Uh-huh. And now, some upcoming things to check out from our friends in the Evolver universe. Evolver produces live, interactive video courses with some of the leading visionaries of transformational culture through our webinar series, the Evolver Intensives. 3 exciting webinars are coming up, and you can find more about them on our website, evolver.net. First, you may already know a bit about raw foods, superfoods, and super herbs. Now learn how to bring their benefits into an everyday diet that's right for you. Join David Wolf, the rock star of superfoods, on Sunday, December 16th for the live, interactive, online video course, Raw Food and the Real World, How to Start a Rawvolution Every Day. This session with David Wolf is one day only. Are you ready for the next Hurricane Sandy? Develop a plan for yourself, your family, and your business for coping with the dangers of an unexpected crisis with Chuck D's favorite survival expert, Anton Edwards,
in the upcoming Evolver Intensive. Preparedness now. Create your own emergency survival plan, starting December 13th. This course with Anton Edwards is a 4-part series. Every shamanic tradition is equipped to battle the negativity that stops us from realizing our true capabilities. Join host Itzhak Berry for the live interactive video course, The Shamanic Path to Spiritual Abundance, Indigenous Techniques for Entering the Flow of Life, and learn from acknowledged masters how to identify and remove the blockages that limit your potential. Two of the elders joining Itzhak for this 6-part Evolver Intensive will be none other than John Perkins and Sandra Ingerman. Go to evolver.net to find out more about any of these webinars. Finally, here's a treat for those of you who like your art beautiful and strange. We have an amazing print entitled Monarch Dragon by visionary artist Android Jones, exclusively on evolver.net. Thanks for joining us for the first edition ever of the Reality Sandwich podcast. We hope to bring you more very, very soon. And to close this episode out, we have Learning to Vomit, Learning to Love, and The Strength It Takes to Be Gentle with actor Penn Badgley from The Gossip Girls. Should be a lot of fun. This was recorded live at Webster Hall for the 2012 Ayahuasca Monologues. We hope to see you on 2013, and we hope to see you next time on the Reality Sandwich podcast. Thanks for tuning in and turning on.
If a banner were to unfurl behind me, it would say, learning to vomit, learning to love. And in parentheses, the strength it takes to be gentle. So I had dreamt of ayahuasca for years, read about it for years. It was like my spiritual porn that I could never actually touch. And then through a long, serendipitous route of cosmic intervention, I ended up in the Colombian rainforest with the Kogi tribe. You should Google them. In the shadow of the Sierra Nevadas, on an ancient beach, you know, like virtually untouched. and I was like, holy shit, this is it. This is everything I've ever wanted. Now I can like have a battle royale with my darkest of demons in the jungle and come back to New York City with a glittering spiritual tool, my spirit wrench, you know, and apply it to the gray mechanisms of the real world and dismantle it all. And So cut to the middle of my first ceremony after I've had my first cup. I got what I wanted, the dark part. The darkness opened up underneath me. It was a chasm that manifested in the form of just the most uncomfortable nausea that became painful, and I didn't know what to do with it. And everyone around me is purging. I mean, you've heard about the purging. You've purged yourself, maybe. Adam encourages me not to purge here, and I'll try not to, but... I couldn't for the life of me. I couldn't let go. You know, everyone around me is retching. It's just like mayhem, and you hear these sounds of people vomiting. It's like, I remember at one point just waking up and being like, oh God, I gotta remember these sounds. Because, I mean, you know, the shaking of the rattles and the leaves, and then people just retching. It's like, you know, you feel like, just the clock is scaled back thousands of years, and it's disorienting and unbelievable. So, after struggling with my nausea for what felt like an eternity, the sun is rising. Most people have like slept for a little bit. They've gone through the cleansing, and I'm just writhing in agony. And I'm still like drunk. I can't stand or sit or sleep. I can't do anything. I'm wondering why. Where the fuck is my spirit wrench? Like, come to me. The darkness had even subsided, and all I had was nausea. And so there was a moment where I was clutching my clothes, standing naked, covered in sand, like about 30 feet from everyone else who's like sort of gaily retelling their stories around the fire. I'm just like, would this just come out? Just come out of me. What is this in? Just come out. And I'm retching, and I'm trying, and I fall to my knees, and I'm spitting, and nothing comes. So I go back and I sit by the fire. And one of the elders in training, an apprentice of some sort, comes to me and gently says, the mamo, and the mamo is the shaman of the tribe. He said, the mamo would like you to put your clothes on, please. And I smiled at him, you know, like woozily, and put my clothes on, which was my shaky path back to sobriety, and then eventually back to the city. And then I didn't drink again for another year and a half. But it precipitated an exceptional period of like personal work, and I was really exploring a lot of that darkness for that year and a half in a way that felt sort of resolute, and I was actually making progress with it. So cut to a year and a half later, I return to the same shaman. There are two of them, a man and a woman, which I think is really significant and beautiful, and I'm grateful for them. I'm in another ceremony, a much smaller one this time. I was actually the only male, and there were four other women. And he was immediately very gentle. And I'd gone there thinking like, all right, I'm going to be brutalized by my demons again, I'm going to do it, you know, it's like that rebellious inclination to wallow in the darkness because of its seductive power. And it didn't come. This gentle internal dialogue came to me that was productive and beautiful, but I went back for a second cup thinking like, all right, now the work is going to begin, right? And all that came was nausea. And again, I was like, all right, well, I'm familiar with this. Let's see if maybe I can purge this time. During this particular ceremony, the four women I was with were, I mean, everything was coming out of them at all ends, and they were it was like, it was mayhem, and I was just in awe. The sounds again, and vomiting in these buckets and plastic bags, running to the bathroom, running outside. I was like, Jesus, why? You know, nothing was coming to me, and I was so nauseous. And at this point, it's becoming like that bowling ball in my stomach, you know. It is a bowling ball. And I became to be aware of it as the qualities of whatever demons were haunting me, self-created or, you know, external, whatever it might be. And one of the shamans suggested I pick up my guitar and play, and I was like, there's no fucking way I'm going to be able to play my guitar right now, but all right, I'll try. And what was interesting about it is that I picked it up, like, skeptical, you know, and he's like, brother, just make sure you play from your heart. And I was like, yeah, all right. And I played, and the moment I picked it up, I understood what he meant, and I began to play. And it was very simple and probably sloppy, but it sounded beautiful to me because it was honest. And the nausea subsided. And the second I put my guitar down, the nausea would come back. So then I kept on picking up my guitar, but then I was so tired because I was so nauseous and I couldn't keep playing, so I'd set it down, and then I'd lay down, and then I'd stand up, I'd go outside and have a cigarette, I would dance, I would sing, I would pray, I would meditate, I would pray for everyone in the room, I would do everything I could, and the nausea kept, I had three massive cups, to the point where the last cup I had, the shaman who gave it to me, when I drank it, went and I was willing it, I was just like, come out! And the more frustrated I got, the less I seemed to be able to let go. So finally, after time, everybody's fallen asleep because the women all were heroes. I mean, heroin, they were everything. They purged for me. And they were mostly resting peacefully while I was having this fever dream, like kind of twitching, this pit demon so real in my belly. And I was like a supercomputer processing terabytes of information, which is actually pretty incredible. I seemed to revisit, process, massage, and file away almost every significant memory of my life. And all in this fevered, nauseous state. And finally, when it was over and I came to the present, I shot up. And I raced outside. No, I raced to the bathroom actually first, and then realized it was going to be loud. So I go outside, freezing cold. I'm in barely any clothing, and I fall on the wet ground, so cold. I put my hand on a rock, and I'm just like, come on. And still, nothing came. To the point where I had to put my finger down my throat, and the most acidic, unrewarding, dismal little purge that was not a purge came out. But it was enough to the point where I didn't feel as though I might actually pass out from the discomfort and pain. So I was humbled and shaky and just put my hand on the rock and could only utter a simple thank you to no one and everyone in particular. And then I went back inside and tried to sleep, couldn't. And I was profoundly weak. So then a month later, I revisited the same shaman, and I'm like, all right, I gotta, like, visions, fuck them. I wanna throw up. Like, that's what I wanna do. I wanna throw up. So let's work on that. So the ceremony began, and again, it was gentle. But this time, you know, as almost as a test, my brain went to the darkness, you know, like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Like, you know, I can attack you with anything you want, if you want it. And I realized how self-created it was, and for the first time in a really resolute way, my darkest of demons, I was like, yeah, I get it, dude, I know you. I understand you, and you don't scare me at all. And the profound sense of love that I was aware of in my life wasn't helping me because it didn't necessarily have to save me from the darkness. And after processing what felt like every memory in my life a month prior, I felt like I understood myself to a point, at least enough, that I was like, all right, so what work is left? Like, all this self-reflection, it just eventually becomes a hall of mirrors. Where's, how am I gonna throw up now? Like, this has got to be part of my journey. I know it is. I can't not throw up now. Everybody here is like shitting themselves, and I can't, you know. So finally, the nausea has come, as it always does. I can't get it out, as I never can. And this time I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to really hold the space for the women during their cleansing, and I'm going to shake this rattle. I'm just going to shake the shit out of this rattle. I'm just going to keep shaking it. I'm not going to lay down. I'm just, oh my God, I grab a bucket next to me, and I'm like, all right, come on. All right, well, it's not going to come anyway. I'm just going to focus on them. I'm going to focus on them. And finally, the female shaman comes to me, and she's like, Ben, if you're going to get well, they call it getting well for obvious reasons, you got to put the rattle down. And I was like, you know, thinking, joke's on you, because I'm not going to get well. So, but I'm, you know, it's just for show. I'm keeping the bucket here. I'm well familiar with this at this point. It's been a year and a half, you know, so I'm just like shaking. And then finally, one of the apprentices behind me, he was sitting behind me, and he's actually here tonight. Thank you. You know who you are. He says to me, right after she walks away, I kept shaking, and then he comes up and he's like, hey, and he puts my hand down, and he's like, if you're going to get well, you have to stop shaking the rattle. And I was about to be like, yeah, dude, but you don't seem to get that I'm not going to, and then I just put the rattle down, and I was like, great, now I'm going to shit myself. So I run outside thinking that I'm going to go to the bathroom. And out of nowhere, in the middle of my tracks, barefoot on the straw, the most glorious vision that was not a vision is golden brown projectile arc just sails out of my mouth, totally, like, without warning. I mean, out of nowhere. I felt as though when I would eventually get well, I would receive a memo, like a spiritual telegraph of at least a decade in advance, and this just came out of nowhere, and it was everywhere, but I it felt graceful. It was not disgusting. I was like, you know, it was such a painless, easy step, which felt counterintuitive because of the necessity that I felt to be brutalized. And the moment that happened, I felt this unbelievable lightness, but simultaneous grounding, and a simple ease that my mind had no part in. Everything had been so conceptual. I had gone from brain thinking to even soul knowing, but I had not had the pleasure and the gift and the humble greatness of heart feeling. And when I went back into the ceremony immediately after, I had the physical sensation that I don't know if I'll be able to explain well, but the physical sensation of every, you know, all of our consciousness seems to be localized up here. We see with our eyes, we think with our brain, we speak with our mouth, it's all in our head. We think about our chakras, and we always focus on these chakras, and even in our throat, you know, it's all very much here. But I had the inexplicable, unbelievable, ancient feeling of dropping into here. I dropped into my heart, and I felt it in my blood, and all of the discomfort and the mercurial nature of your perceptual boundaries during these ceremonies seem to melt away and all meld into one like gleaming psychic arrow pointing to my heart and being like, that's it, you know. We can have visions of the future or the past or the present, but I mean, what is it without truly knowing your heart? And And that was really, I think, the simplest, but to this day, the most profound moment of my life. And for that reason, I know and knew then that I will always be walking with the plant, with the medicine. I mean, I struggled with calling it the medicine, but now I know why they call it that. And that is how I learned to love through vomiting. Thank you. And obviously, thank you, Evolver. Thank you, Dr. Jonathan and Adam. You guys are great in helping me today.